KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, we meet real Russian royalty. Russian Prince Andrew Romanov, now a West Marin artist, joins us to talk about his life and art, along with some conversation about pre-Bolshevik Romanov rule with Stanford historian of Russia, Robert Cruz, and Hoover archivist Elena Danielson. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum. The Romanov family ruled Russia from 1613 until the Bolshevik Revolution led to their being deposed and ultimately slaughtered, but for the few who escaped. Tsar Nicholas's second sister, Xenia, was one member of the family who got away, and she and her family were given refuge at Windsor Castle by England's King George V. Her son, Andrew Romanov, presently an artist here in the Bay Area and the grandnephew to Tsar Nicholas, was born in London in 1923 and served in the British Navy in World War II. In 1956, he became a U.S. citizen, and he is married to famed local artist Inez Storer. His drawings and paintings are presently on display through the 24th of February at Gallery 16 in San Francisco, and his autobiography, which includes his artwork, was published under the title The Boy Who Would Be Tsar, The Art of Prince Andrew Romanov. He joins us for this morning's Forum as we look back at pre-Bolshevik Romanov ruled Russia with the Stanford historian Robert Cruz and Hoover archivist Elena Danielson, and Inez Storer is with us as well. And before we meet all of them, we're going to talk with Griff Williams, who is the owner and director of Gallery 16, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you. And I guess the this is first of all, to the autobiography, this is a pretty amazing story, how someone would be born to be the heir, and let's not confuse this Prince Andrew with the man known as Randy Andy over in the British Isles,
right,
but born into royalty and winding up as an artist in Bolinas and selling hookahs and things like that. I mean, it's quite a story.
It's an unbelievable story, and it's charmed and kind of magical. And, you know, everybody that we're talking to about the life's story of Andrew can't believe it. It's part of the reason why we decided to publish the book.
Well, you're also not only involved in publishing the book and designing it, but curating the show. And we ought to talk about this. On one hand, we hear it's sort of billed as folk art, these shrinky-dinks. Somebody says, shrinky-dinks? What kind of art comes out of shrinky-dinks? Give us an explanation, can you?
Well, the material itself is really a child's toy. It's a you know, a sheet of plastic that's kind of brushed on one side, and you draw on it, and it shrinks by two-thirds in the oven. And it's a sort of a magical little experience for children, and my guess is that Andrew gravitated to it, much like a lot of parents and grandparents do by playing with their children or grandchildren. It is, however, in his hands, much more rooted in that kind of folk art tradition. He's really turned it into a medium of his own.
Which folk are we talking about here? This is a man with Russian bloodlines who grew up in England.
Well, you know, he's a very common, normal, you know, everyday a guy. He has an amazing title, but quite like you and I.
This is sort of out of the ordinary of what he shows generally, isn't it?
Well, no, actually,
I mean, what you show, excuse me. Yeah.
The work that we've done with Andrew and the past couple of shows that we've done with him, have all been within this context, all on that material. Occasionally, you know, some sculpture, paintings on plywood, but still really outside the context of the traditional expectation of a painting on canvas.
And if someone says to you, is it art?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's... I think in some ways it's a kind of object lesson for young artists to find not only a medium but a form that is true to yourself. And, aside from the prevailing perception that artists are all about the facility to render a thing, you know, to make it look like the thing they're drawing, Andrew's drawings are certainly not classically beautiful in that way, but they're charming and vulnerable and very true to himself.
Griff Williams, again, is the owner of director of Gallery 16 here in San Francisco, and sort of taking it out of the book and put it in the exhibit, huh, Griff?
Yeah, the exhibition itself is much broader scope in terms of what Andrew's making. The book was really about the childhood growing up at Windsor Castle, and the drawings that he made kind of illustrate that sort of magical childhood that he had growing up on the grounds at Windsor.
Yeah, you got Queen Mary calling him, you have Andrew calling her Auntie Mary, and it takes his cap off to the king. These incidents right out of episodes, right out of childhood.
That's right. He's
living in a cottage in Windsor Castle. Yeah.
Eating chocolate eggs that were meant for Queen Elizabeth.
Well, thank you, Griff, for joining us and giving us this picture of the exhibit and of Andrew's life, which we're going to take up here and also talk about pre-Bolshevik Tsarist Russia and Russia under Nicholas II. In fact, let me say hello to Andrew Romanov, who is grandnephew of Russia's last Tsar, Nicholas II, an author and an artist, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very happy to be on this program.
I'm delighted to have you here, and I said to you before we went on the air, and I'll say it publicly, that this is a man, he may have been born in 1923, but he looks like one of my contemporaries. Paul Libertor, an old friend of mine, wrote about you and said he couldn't believe how youthful you look, and I've got to say it for the air as well.
No, thank you.
Robert Cruz, also with us this morning, assistant professor at Stanford, specializes in the Russian Empire, Central Asia, and Islam, and in fact has published a book recently, a Harvard University book called For Profit and Tsar, and we welcome you to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. We're also with Elena Danielson, who's archivist emerita with Hoover Institution at Stanford, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
And as I said before, Inez Storr is with us in studio as well. We may bring her into the conversation, but first let me talk with you, Andrew, and talk about, actually, here you had this background with British royalty, but there wasn't a whole lot of contact. I mean, I guess your mother had tea with them, but for the most part, you were kind of like the squatters in Windsor Castle or something.
Right. Well, actually, it's my grandmother, not my mother.
I'm sorry, your grandmother's name.
Yes. She would go and be invited to the castle, and there's a story in my book about her leaving in the carriage and kicking her leg up and saying, "I'm off to tea with the king and queen." So, as you said, I didn't have much connection with the royalty of England.
But you do have royalty running in your own blood, and we'll talk about Nicholas II, who just been reading about it, reading Norman Mailer's new novel, and he takes us through, it's about Hitler, but suddenly he says, if you want to continue with this, you can continue with it. If you don't want to, there's a chapter here about Nicholas II's coronation. You can just go ahead and move to page one. It's a very odd experience reading it. What has this bloodline meant to you, I mean, ultimately, or what does it mean to you now?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to talk about it because I am a British subject. I was born in England. I have my connections there, and my heart is with Russia, and now an American citizen. So about the past, I have a hard time myself connecting myself to the Tsarist family.
You feel pretty much independent of that past because you grew up in England and were part of the British Navy and all that?
That's very true. Uh-huh.
But when you say you feel Russia, what is it that you feel about Russia?
I feel the warmth, an enormous expanse of a wonderful country and the people there. And that's probably what I mean when I say that.
And I had mentioned hookahs before. I wasn't trying to be flippant or anything, but actually you did have a smoking paraphernalia store in Bolinas and worked there as a carpenter and so forth. I mean, this is not what one associates usually with the kind of pedigree you have.
That's quite true. But times are hard, and sometimes one needs to do work and raising six kids, and I need to find a job, so that was an opportunity to get involved with the making of these different media for smoking, and we also made jewelry.
To make a living, yeah. I had mentioned some of the drawings you've done that come out of your childhood. There's also one where you're praying over your mother's coffin. Your mother died in a bomb blast. And there's one where called A Romantic Way to Spend an Evening, where someone is digging into the trash for Viagra. I mean, this is pretty broad range of emotions you've got going here.
That's quite true, yes, indeed.
I'm talking with Prince Andrew Romanov, grandnephew of Russia's last Tsar, Nicholas II, an author and artist, and his recent collection of drawings and his book release for The Boy Who Would Be Tsar, The Art of Prince Andrew Romanov, will be at Gallery 16 until February 24th. Robert Cruz is assistant professor at Stanford. He specializes in the Russian Empire, Central Asia, and Islam, and I guess it's easy to say that history has not been too flattering to Tsar Nicholas, even though there's been an attempt to kind of resurrect him in Russia in the 90s.
Sure, it's a difficult legacy, and I appreciate Andrew's sense of unease about feeling a direct connection to that particular family because of the very tortured political history of the early 20th century. I think Elena Danielson will have a somewhat more sympathetic picture, I think, of the complexities of the period. Nicholas, of course, is renowned as a great family man who loved his four daughters and son, and much of the personal memorabilia that we have around the last Tsar demonstrates this great love for his family, for his love of outdoor activities, for the cultivation of the artistic abilities of his own family.
And that's yet, all on the plus side, but he was a man pretty removed from.
Yes, I mean, that's the, unfortunately, I mean, he certainly cuts a kind of sympathetic figure as a family man. As a ruler, of course, the story is more complicated. He ruled a country that was only less than a generation removed from serfdom. It was part of an international system that gave rise to the First World War and to the deaths of some 8 million people during that horrible tragedy. So for historians, Nicholas II does bear a very heavy burden for the legacy of the First World War and for the collapse of the Tsarist empire.
The monarchy fell in great part because of the First World War, did it not?
It did. It did. In fact, like previous monarchs, defeat in war and the threat to Russia's great power status were the chief challenges to the monarchy. And in fact, he was ill-fated to simply be on the throne at a moment when the Russian army was incapable of standing up to the Germans and the Habsburgs.
We know now that it was Lenin who was probably responsible for the idea of slaughtering the whole family of the Tsar.
That is most likely true, but there was some local initiative on the part of the his guards and some local Bolsheviks in the Urals Mountains who saw this as an opportunity to make their name within the party and to demonstrate that, you know, a world had been turned upside down, that the little man had now risen to power in Russia.
The Bolsheviks managed to seize St. Petersburg in large part because of the social crisis and the chaos following what was coming apart at the seams, really.
That's right. I mean, the war was the chief cause. Something like 70% of the Russian officer corps was killed off as a result of the offensives. And a new generation of younger, more plebeian, less educated officers came to the fore. And they led a kind of revolt at the front. So the army literally melted away as young men returned back to the villages to claim land. In Petrograd itself, Nicholas II had renamed St. Petersburg Petrograd because Petersburg sounded too German, and to reduce any claims that, you know, this wasn't a truly authentically Russian monarchy, the Petrograd became, you know, the new capital. But there too, the Tsar faced massive strikes. Over a million people struck in early 1917, and then in February of 1917, women took to the streets in enormous numbers, demanding bread and demanding justice from the Tsar. And it was the confluence of those two events, the defeats at the front, the loss of trust in the Russian general staff, and then these bread riots in Petrograd that ultimately convinced Nicholas II to abdicate in favor of his brother Michael.
Talking again with Robert Cruz, assistant professor at Stanford, specializing in Russian Empire, Central Asia, and Islam. And I was mentioning reading Norman Mailer's new novel where he talks about the coronation of Nicholas II, spends a whole kind of digressive chapter on that, but thousands were trampled to death as a result of that.
Yes, it's a tragic story, but it was one that had a lot of meaning for Russian common folk in particular, because there were many Russian mystics and peasants who believed that this was some kind of sign from God. I mean, Nicholas II himself believed in divine providence. He believed that he had been anointed to rule the empire by God. But for many Russian peasants who shared this view, the tragedy surrounding the coronation seemed to suggest that something was wrong with his Tsar. There was something ill-fated about him and about his family. And then in the context of the First World War, as this apocalypse came home for more and more Russian peasants, people literally retreated from this image of the monarch as a just figure sent by God.
Well, that, in a sense, was resurrected, forgive the verb, but there was an attempt to canonize him and martyr, make him into a martyr back in, that started in the 90s, really, in Russia. You know?
Yes, I mean, with the discrediting of the Soviet Union and of the socialist cause in Russia, many people look to the pre-revolutionary past to look for something more authentic about Russian culture. And for many, especially in the Russian Orthodox Church, the Romanov dynasty, it appeared to be the most authentic representation of something generally Russian that preceded the Bolshevik disaster.
Well, that Russian nationalism just fell fuel to that, obviously.
It did. And in fact, in 2000, after a decade of lay lobbying, lay support for the cause, the Russian Orthodox Church canonized the family in a ceremony in 2000, in a move that was quite controversial because many Russians also remembered the Soviet era with more complexity and pointed again to the disaster of the First World War and to some of the failings of Nicholas II and questioned his identity as literally a saint.
Again, Robert Cruz, assistant professor at Stanford. Lena Danielson is an archivist emerita at Hoover Institution at Stanford, well represented at university here this morning. And it's fair to say, Professor Cruz was talking about Nicholas II as being a family man and all these positive things, and we actually associate him probably more with Rasputin and his son being cured of hemophilia, as well as Anastasia, whatever happened to her. I mean, these are fascinating stories that continue to hold our interest and engage our interest. But he was an autocrat, and he was anti-Semitic, and he was, by most accounts, like most of the monarchists of that period, not exactly with his people.
So Bob can defend his profession as a historian very capably. I want to give the archivist point of view. So I bought into the whole narrative about the Romanov rule, about the autocracy, how terrible everything was, anti-Semitism, the whole mix. And I bought into that story as a student. And then working in the Hoover archives over 27 years, piece by piece, collections would be opened that hadn't been opened before. So Prince Vasily of Woodside brought a trunk of some of Ksenia's diaries. He hadn't been allowed to read them. Himself.
You mean there's another Russian prince besides Andrew out here? You have princes in both sides of the bay?
Vasily is Andrew's uncle, and he's now deceased. But Vasily was a delightful man. He brought these diaries, and he said, I wasn't allowed to read these. But these are the diaries of Andrew's grandmother, who you can see in this stunning gown here. My grandmother didn't dress like that. And the diaries, one by one, we'd start opening them and, you know, visualizing her in this, you know, jewel-encrusted gown. I thought her diaries would be very arrogant. I thought she would be very superficial and frivolous because that was the image that I had absorbed from the history textbooks. Then when you look at the diaries and you read them, she's a delightful person. She's warm. She's kind. She's thoughtful. She's very concerned about the political turmoil. And you can see the development of her political thought, her sympathy with her people. She absolutely did not want to leave Russia. So after the revolution, she stayed on until 1919, and she was forced to leave. Her aunt, who was the Queen of England, insisted and sent the Marlborough to rescue her. And there is this heartbreaking passage in her diary where she says, they're forcing us to leave. The horror of it, the pain, the despair. The dishonesty towards the people whom I leave here, we cover ourselves with shame. So
your whole narrative changed as a result of your archivist work.
Absolutely.
And not only created more sympathy for you, but began to see perhaps a more sympathetic view of this whole family? I mean, particularly
yes.
The monarch and his family?
Well, to see them as real people.
Yeah.
Who have flaws, too. I mean, they weren't perfect by any means. And they had fights and divorces, and there were all kinds of intrigues and things. So it wasn't a perfect. They weren't perfect. I don't think of them as saints myself, but as real human beings and extraordinary. The one thing that comes up in every generation among both the men and the women, they're extraordinarily artistic. So we did an exhibition with GARF, which is the Federal Archives in Moscow.
They were working with shrinky dinks, though, were they?
They worked with watercolor. And if you compare the watercolors,
miniatures, though, yeah.
Small watercolors, very beautifully done, with a great sense of color. And if you compare Andrew's work with these watercolors. Andrew's work is more modern and more updated, but it's not abstract, and it still has this connection with this incredible sense of color. And you can see that in the decorated letters that Andrew's grandmother used to write. His great-grandmother wrote, we have letters in Hoover that his great-grandmother, who was the Empress of Russia, the Tsarina, wrote to her sister, the Queen of England. And there would be beautiful little watercolor details in the margins of the letters, maybe a pansy, because pansies mean think of me, or I'm thinking of you. And so the artistic sense was highly cultivated, and it was not arrogant. It was not ostentatious. It was very connected with nature.
Robert Cruz, you want to add something here?
Sure, no. Elena's a more charitable person than I am, so she's drawn a lovely portrait, and I'm sympathetic. Historians take a somewhat dimmer view when they look at this in a wider political canvas. But I think Elena's right on to say that the personal correspondence, most of which was in English.
I had her narrative. I mean, this was a monarch who was removed, not exactly let him eat cake, but, tried to be with the people, but was fairly aloof. Full of pomp and hubris and all that.
I think you were right the first time. I think, it's extremely complicated. I mean, I think if, as a family man, I think one can admire certain of those qualities.
It's not that Hoover wants the monarchy back, is it?
No.
No, yeah, but it's the political history is quite quite damning, I think. But sure, that a more complicated picture that Elena's suggesting is certainly merited.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion. In fact, I've never revealed this on air before, but Andrew and I have something in common. I may have Russian royalty blood. I'm joking about this in part, but if you open a Collier's Encyclopedia and go to Russia, the history of Russia, it gives all the rulers, the Romanov rulers as well as the pre-Romanov rulers, and there was an Ivan Krasny, so help me. You can see it, same spelling, and all, of course Krasny means red in Russian, so he may have been Ivan the Red with a red beard or something of that sort, but there it is in Collier's. Inez, come on the microphone here. Princess Inez, I guess it is technically, since you are man and wife, right?
Oh, I suppose so, but I never use it.
Never use the title, huh?
And I have a different name, so I can get away with it.
You're certainly a highly regarded artist and someone who is great respected for your humanist work and so forth. How did you two meet?
Well, it's a typical 70s story. He was in Inverness, where I was living with four kids, and I was divorced. And I saw this man, and I knew he was Russian, but I didn't know anything else. And I also knew another Russian there, and I said, "Who is that man?" And he said, "Oh, you mean Andrew? He's my cousin." And he said, "Why, do you want to meet him?" And I said, no. And just be cool about it. And, of course, he went right to him and he said, "There's this woman with four kids. The youngest one's 9, and she wants to meet you." Well, that, to make a long story short, it took about a year. And then we sort of courted. And he lived in the downtown in the village, and I lived about a block away in the old Inverness Hotel. And after about a year, he moved in with his menagerie of animals and two kids and my four, and it was a study in the Brady Bunch, and I don't think I'd ever do it again, but we did it.
Very unusual Brady Bunch, Russian prince and famed artist. Let me open up the phone lines and invite those of you who are listening to join us. Lots of things to talk about here, obviously, Russian history before the Bolshevik Revolution during the Romanov regime, and also Andrew Romanov and his life and art. And you can join us now toll free from wherever you're listening to us at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. talking with Elena Danielson from Hoover, and she's archivist emerita there, Robert Cruz, who is assistant professor at Stanford, Andrew Romanov. And we talked earlier with Griff Williams from Gallery 16. We'll talk with you. If you care to join us, it's toll-free again, 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about Russia and talking particularly about the era before the Bolshevik Revolution, when Nicholas II was Tsar, and his grandnephew is here with us in studio. He lives in the Bay Area now in Inverness and is a artist, and in fact has a book out as well, The Boy Who Would Be Tsar, the Art of Prince Andrew Romanov, which is at Gallery 16 in San Francisco until the 24th of February. And by the way, he'll be reading from his book up at Point Reyes Books on Sunday, February 11th at 5 o'clock. Also with us this hour, Robert Cruz, who is assistant professor of history at Stanford. This is his area. That is this area of Russian history, along with the Russian Empire, Central Asia, and Islam, and Elena Danielson, archivist emerita with the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and local artist Inez Storer, who is the wife of Andrew Romanoff, therefore Princess Inez Storer is with us as well in studio. I was just talking off air about the Anastasia story. And by the way, you can join us again toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Technically, as I said, Anastasia, we were saying Anastasia still may be out there. Maybe she'd be about, what, 110, Elena? But it remains a kind of fascinating story to so many people.
When I was working in the Hoover Archives, almost once a month, somebody would come in looking for evidence of Anastasia in the archives. So the myth has created this incredible, you know, sense of, you know, enigma, what was going on, what happened to her. And I don't think that will ever be put to rest. No matter how much evidence and hard facts we accumulate, people will always be in love with the mystery of that story.
Well, certainly, you can tell by the number of novels and films that have been made about it. I mean, it's been an extraordinary part of popular culture. Now we have DNA testing, so I presume we could, if she came forward, if she called in today and said, here I am, we could determine whether indeed it was Anastasia. Andrew, question from one of our listeners. Has your family made any effort, or did your family make any effort to recover land or other possessions since the fall of the Soviet Union?
That's a good question. We did one time with my cousins try and get some of the properties back, but they said they're historical places and we cannot do that. So we didn't, our efforts were stunted, so we never did get anything.
Well, we're going to get some phone calls, and we'll start, Walter, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I enjoy your shows always.
Thank you.
My question was for Prince Romanoff, is that I have a very vague recollection of one of the perhaps great-grandfather of yours went a trip to Europe, in southern Europe, probably Italy or so. He enjoyed seeing and experiencing a ship was built, a wooden ship. He actually took part of building it. As much as that he was probably his mid-age, and he helped building that ship. So he showed so much interest in art of building that ship, and shows a big interest in that. I wonder if this has anything to do with your interest in carpentry. And I know you mentioned the carpentry was more like making a living. Did you see any passion or any interest into that? To see any type of artwork, you know, come out of that, because an artist can be a painter, but they still enjoy any other type of art.
The question is, were you moved into carpentry as a craft, really, maybe even more, or as an art by dint of shipbuilding? And
no, I don't believe that was from that point of view. It was mainly as a way of making a living, and my cousin was an architect around Marin County, and he was building houses, and he invited me to be a carpenter there, and that was the way I started doing carpentry.
I thank the caller. Actually, I think we've got another artist from Inverness here on the air with us. Good morning, Steve.
Oh, hi. That's quicker than I expected. A couple of points. One is, I know there used to be an artist, he passed away, Gordon Onslow Ford, who lived in Inverness and was connected with the upper crust and the upper classes of England, a fairly seminal force in some parts of the Surrealist movement, and didn't know if you had had any communications together or not when he was alive. That's question one. And then question two would have to do with the American sculptor Frederick Hart did a rather substantial piece called The Four Daughters of Odessa, and it actually has a photograph of those Romanoff daughters, and his sculpture of that is quite a striking piece. Prince Charles owns the first one to be produced. I wondered if you were familiar with that.
Andrew Romanoff.
Well, Gordon Onslow Ford was a friend of mine, and we'd visit with him every so often. And he would show me how he did his work, and it was very extraordinary. He spent like 10 years doing line, circle, dot kind of art, and he would make enormous paintings in this media until he later on became a colorist. But the early ones were all black and white. I think my wife Inez was more connected with Gordon Oslo Ford than I was, because she knew him before me.
How long do you spend on your pieces, roughly?
It can be anywhere from like 1 hour or maybe a day. It depends.
And he also asked you about the Frederick Hart. Are you familiar with that painting?
No, I don't have his knowledge about him at all.
Well, let me thank Steve for the call. What do you have left from Russia and from your inheritance? The letters are pretty much what you had and what you have?
Well, there were...
Other than memory, of course.
No, there were things which were left when my sister died, and they were left for my brother and myself, and we sold them off at a kind of wonderful silver and gold, which we needed to part with, which I didn't want to part with, but I had to share with my brother, Michael, in Australia.
Here's a caller, Bert from San Jose. What is this about hand-painted plates?
Yeah.
Tell us.
My folks who were, my dad was in the Foreign Service, and he was stationed in Munich, and he purchased these plates in a store in Munich, and they're beautiful hand-painted with the Tsar Nicholas II stamp on the back of them. And I was wondering if there is any interest in such a collection.
Elena Danielson, I imagine from an archivist standpoint,
if the plates have some connection with history, definitely they should be looked at by either a museum curator or an archivist to determine the historical worth and the artistic worth. Yeah, so I would definitely get them looked at.
We keep hearing, Robert Cruz, about Nicholas's reign and the Romanov family and art. Fairly unusual, all these connections to art?
Well, it is. I mean, I think that for historians, generally, I think what stands out about Nicholas II is his interest in, actually, in Russian medieval art. He had a vision of a pre-Petrine Russia, that is, before the era of Peter the Great, that he held up as a kind of political ideal, because it was a moment in which, or so he imagined, the Tsar was united with the people, that they were joined by a kind of pious sense of mutual affection with one another. So at the coronation that you mentioned earlier, many of the themes of the 17th century were brought to life. He named his son Alexei after the Tsar Alexei, who was really the embodiment of this 17th century understanding of Orthodox piety, which also became subject of the major building schemes of Nicholas II to try to reproduce what contemporary architects and artists described as a neo-Russian style, that is an authentically Russian style that was not European, that was pre-Petrine, that is, before the moment that Peter the Great introduced Europeanization to Russia. So this is thought of being something distinctively Russian, and it would logically follow that Russia should have its own distinctive political institutions, unlike those in Western Europe, that would reflect the same artistic sentiment.
Andrew, you were certainly related to the British royalty, which is why they took you in and why you stayed at Windsor Castle, but You were brought up Russian Orthodox, I assume. Right?
I was brought up Russian Orthodox.
And so
correct.
your Windsor cousins were Anglican. Was that any kind of conflict or problem? Or
Never came up? No.
Very ecumenical. I'm going to go to another caller. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. And we'll go to Woodland. Isaac, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I have a question for Prince Romanov. Друг, привет. Доброе утро. Меня зовут Исаак. Я счастлив и приятно познакомиться. Извини, мой русский не отлично. Плохо.
Понятно.
The question I had for was, having lived in Russia and then in Britain and then to America, I was wondering if you had any, if it was difficult to change as far as the culture, because I immigrated here from Mexico, and after a while you assimilate into the culture, and it changes a little bit about how you think and sometimes your traditions. I was wondering, since you lived in three major countries, if you have any changes as far as your culture.
That's a good question. I have a total support of America, and I have warmth towards Britain and Russia, and I don't think I have changed over the years. It's been very, very much the same love of all these countries.
Did you live in Russia, actually?
No, I didn't live in Russia. The first time I went was 1990.
Yeah. Isaac, where did you learn Russian so well?
I live in Woodland, but I used to work in West Sacramento, and there is a big Russian community, and I have many friends who are Russian and have been fascinated by the culture. And since I like to climb mountains, there's a mountain in Kazakhstan that I would like to go and climb someday, so I'm practicing.
Well, your по-русски is очень хорошо.
Oh, извини.
Yeah.
Спасибо.
Спасибо большое.
Ничего, yeah. Thank you for the call. You know, actually, I just want to mention this. When I learned Russian in high school, and I should have learned it. You know, a lot of it gets pretty rusty, obviously, because I don't use it. But I was supposed to have learned it with a Leningrad accent. At least that's what the teacher said. Now, do you when you speak to Russians, what kind of accent do they hear? Because you lived in England and you grew up in England.
Mostly they say old Russian and pre-revolutionary Russian, and also Scandinavian accent, they say I have. So that's the way.
Your accent could pass, actually, for Swedish, or I was thinking that, or Danish.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Here's a listener in Roner Park who says, I met a young woman on a coast-to-coast trip on board a hippie bus back in 1979, and if I am not mistaken, her last name was Romanov. I was told she lived in a commune in Bodega Bay. One of your children?
No, I don't think I ever met this young lady. It's an interesting story, though.
And another listener wants to know, if you were back to Russia, how were you greeted?
I was greeted very warmly after they found out who I was. And there's a story when I went to one of the palaces, the people in charge there said, we thought all the Romanovs are dead, and we're so glad to see you. This is your place. Come on, enter. And that was the way they...
You and Inez could have maybe shacked up there for a while, huh?
How about
just
that?
Stayed in one of the royal bedrooms or something. Made squatter's rights and just establish yourself there. Why is this important to get all this history and to get these letters and all these artifacts, Elena Danielson?
Well, you don't know the present until you know the past. And you don't understand the inner workings of history without knowing the personalities. And I think the archives stand as a very important corrective to the mythology that grows up around some of these tragic stories like the murder of the Romanovs. To have the actual facts, then you know what happened. And then you have a founding in truth. So you can't operate without some kind of founding in truth, and that's what archives provide.
Have we learned anything new about the Rasputin story? Has that narrative changed much? You know, this mystical, mesmerizing, demonic figure who had sway over Nicholas and his whole family.
Now, I'm not up to speed on the Rasputin story. Maybe Bob knows more about it than I do.
Can you help us here, Bob?
No, I don't think the story has changed very much. To add to Elena's answer, I think that particularly in the context of Putin's Russia, I think light needs to be shed on the politics of the late imperial period, because Putin has very much subconsciously tried to resurrect a lot of the political symbolism and indeed political language and geopolitical ambition of the last Tsar. And we can see this in Georgia and the Caucasus. I mean, the whole story of Russian Chechnya is part of post-Soviet Russia's attempts to re-embrace some aspects of its imperial heritage. So this is very much, I think, an issue that makes the study of pre-revolutionary Russia so important for students of contemporary politics and international affairs.
That influence, I mean, you think of Yeltsin, obviously not to much extent with Gorbachev, but even Brezhnev and some of these former Soviet leaders who conducted themselves and comported themselves often in a kind of czarist fashion.
Well, yeah, I think many of them...
Putin especially.
I think many of them adopted the viewpoint of Nicholas II, which posited that, you know, that the Russian people is childlike, that Russian culture demands a strong ruler. And Putin certainly draws on this this understanding of Russian popular culture, that Russians aren't quite ready for democracy, that they need a strong hand.
We're going to go to George next. George, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. My parents were both born in Russia, and I was wondering what it would be like to do a search for my ancestry. My grandfather was supposedly a governor of the province of Vinnytsia before the revolution. And I've always thought of going back, just like in the movie, Everything is Illuminated. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie.
Nobody seems to be, I'm sorry to say.
Well, it's out on DVD. It's Elijah Wood who goes back to find a village that was destroyed by the Nazis during the war.
Oh, I'm sorry. Everything is Illuminated. That's the Jonathan Safran Foer novel that was made into a film.
Right.
I thought you said Everything is Illuminated.
No. Well, it was Illuminated, but it's also Illuminated. So, but, you know, I've often thought about going back. I don't know what it would be like, how the people would respond to that, and whether it would be easy to do research on family history.
Well, Andrew, you said it was a warm reception that you got. What about in general, Bob Cruise or Lena Danielson, any thoughts about this?
It is possible to do genealogical research now. Mm-hmm. The Russian archivists have done a lot of work organizing the records, so they're now becoming more accessible. And there have been some very, very good genealogical searches, but it is not simple. So I would estimate the amount of time you think you would need to do the preparatory work on your genealogical research in Russia, then multiply it by 10, and then you'll get a sense of the time commitment it would take. But the archivists in Russia are outstandingly capable people.
And George, we thank you for the call. Princess Inez, let me get you back into this conversation here. You two, Andrew said you're his right hand when you came in. And how do you two work together in his art? How does that manifest?
Well, it's interesting. people ask me that all the time. Does he influence you? Do you influence him? And I think, yeah. My work is very different than his in a certain aspect because it's very contemporary. But I'm also have also been interested in folk art and naive and outsider art and the kind of spontaneity that it engenders. And so I'll look at Andrew's work. Probably it's just like it seeps through the subconscious. And I often have him come into my studio and I say, so what's wrong with this painting? And he, without education in art school and all of that business, he can zero right in, and it's sort of called the third eye, and it's an intuitive kind of process. And the way he works, he drives me crazy because he'll have an exhibition, and I look at it and it's like a month away, and nothing is happening, and so I start nagging. And saying, you know, you've got to put this together. I will do it. So it's probably ADHD, but the last 2 weeks he'll pull it off, whereas I'm always working way ahead of time for an exhibition. So it's an interesting.
So right hand means that you nag him.
Yeah. Yeah, basically I am admitting it on the air, and he just threw his hand in the air and said,
he gave
yes.
a thumbs up, yeah, confirm that. You talk about outsider art, though.
I mean,
by that, that's the whole genre that we're talking about here, and it's Andrew's work, I mean this not in any critical sense, but it's reminiscent of cartoon in some way.
Yes, it is. And interestingly enough, in some of the archive collection that he has and he got from his uncle and his father and his mostly, they had a lot of political cartoons in around the 20s and illustrations. And his family on all of the... What blew me away when I started meeting his relatives was that they were all artists, and some in more or less in the cartoon aspect, and others were more illustrative. But I, at one point, wanted to do an exhibition of this family and of all of the different people that had in his family who had made art, and was very surprised in how... prolific they were, and they seemed to continue to do it throughout their lives. Even his uncle had his own sort of naive way of making art. So I think everyone I know have met in the family has been making art.
So we're talking about a royal pedigree as well as an art-making pedigree?
Yeah.
And the two seem to certainly be conjoined in many ways here. So how else do you help him, aside from nagging him?
Well, when I was trying to chase him down in the early years, I was teaching figure painting, and I said, oh, Andrew, you should really come in and take this class. So it's been an ongoing, sort of seduction in that way. And because I taught for so long at the Art Institute, I had a lot of information that I would bring home. And my students, I would have them come out And they absolutely thought they'd died and gone to heaven because they'd never been in a household where he immediately said, now, come on, we're going to make Shrinky Dinks. And these are, you know, graduate students and undergraduates. And they would sit there. I finally say, look, I'm going to bed. I don't know about you guys, but because they didn't want to leave. So there's something in that naive sort of spontaneity of just making art and not getting all intellectual about it that is really a draw.
And you say that in some instances, Andrew was saying that it'll take him an hour even just to bring forth something.
Yeah, and I envy that because I
was going to say, that's not the way
through.
You work, is
no.
it?
No. I mean, the aha system theory doesn't happen all that often, but he uses the new... the other running battle in our family is that he collects newspapers that I know he's never going to read or magazines, but he is so afraid that he'll forget some weird thing that he read in the newspaper that he wants to translate into his cartoon. So he keeps everything just in case. Well, so that's where the information's coming from, I think.
I was just going to say, this is time that we ask for your public support, those of you listening to us on KQED and KQEI, and hope that you will be forthcoming with that. Those of you who are listening to us on Sirius, we will continue our broadcast. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And a couple of emails here. This comes from John in Walnut Creek. Boy, it's a big question. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia moved toward democracy. Now it appears to be moving back toward a more authoritarian system. Question. Unlike other countries with similar levels of social and economic development, Russia has never been able to establish a stable democracy. Why not? Well, from a historian's standpoint, Robert Cruz?
That's an enormous question. If I had a perfect answer, I probably would be in the White House somewhere. But I think that one can point to several factors. But
Wait a minute. Doesn't Condi Rice have the perfect answer? No.
Well, yes. So she thought. No, I think one very important factor is Russia's continued imperial ambitions. I think one of the choices Russian elites have to confront is whether or not they want to be an empire or a kind of democracy that rests on the popular will. And I think that the two goals are inconsistent. And I think that the Putin government, indeed like the Yeltsin government, would prefer to be an empire of sorts. And so I think Chechnya is the most dramatic example of the conflict between these two goals. And I think that this is a choice, that is deeply embedded in Russian history and in the self-conception of Russian elites, that their goal as the stewards of the Russian state is to maintain an empire, a great power.
We're also thinking when that poisoning took place, that there was something in that that was indicative of Russian history with all these intrigues. And I mean, you can see it in the Medicis, you can see it in a lot of national histories, but to some extent it was resonant of a lot of Russian history, was it not, Elena Danielson?
Well, when you read the diaries and the correspondence of the Romanovs, they're always concerned about assassinations. In their case, they were the targets.
Right.
So violence and terror isn't something new in the world. Alexander II was assassinated, and that created deep anxiety in the Romanov family. And so maybe Bob can correct me, but there is a sense of encirclement that you get among Russian leaders, that they're under threat. And you found that in the Romanovs, and you find that in the Soviet era, and it seems to be also present in the Putin era, that we're surrounded by enemies, they're out to get us, we have to fight back. So there's a funny dynamic there that's part of the imperial legacy.
Something that's both paranoid and real at the same time. Yeah.
And there's definitely a real element. You just don't know what's real and what's not, which is what's so disturbing, I think.
Another one of our listeners, Nafis, writes, I'm glad to hear that your guest, the grandson of the Tsar, actually grandnephew, said that when he grew up in England with the royals, he had no conflict whatsoever with the English royals because he was Orthodox and they were Anglicans. It illustrates to the historian that religious conflicts aren't due to religion, but, this listener says, economics. But speaking of economics, Andrew, how were you able to support yourselves, your family, that is? Or were you supported by the British royalty?
Hardly. Each member of the family, my uncles and all, they all never did any work before, and they all started from the bottom, and they got jobs, and that's the way they supported themselves. And Granny had some jewelry and things like that, and she would sell it off and create a little bit of money. to help out along to keep the household going.
But most of the treasures of the royal family were not to be taken out of the country by you or by anybody else. They remained there, and they got what the Bolsheviks got control of them?
Well, a lot of it came out of the family. The Empress Dowager had many good pieces of works of various different artists, and over the years they were sold off.
So they're... But when the Bolsheviks took over, Bob Cruz, I mean, for the most part, they, the suggestion that Lenin was responsible for the liquidation of this family, this horrible slaughter of the Romanov family, they wanted to erase this history, didn't they, pretty much?
They did, and they largely succeeded for a generation or two of Soviet citizens. They sold off, they managed to sell off many of the symbols of the monarchy. There was a fire sale in Europe with all of the, many of the jewels and gold that ended up in private hands in European markets, and they successfully, of course, rewrote the history of the Russian Empire and to write the Romanovs out and present them exclusively as villains.
Well, we've come to the end of this hour, and kind of fascinating connection of art and history this hour. I want to thank all of you and remind listeners that the drawings and the book release for The Boy Who Would Be Tsar, The Art of Prince Andrew Romanov, will be at Gallery 16 until the 24th of February. And you can meet Prince Andrew, not the British one, but the Russian one, Sunday, February 11th. He'll be reading 5 o'clock at Point Reyes Books. Our thanks to you, Andrew Romanov. Good to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael. This is great.
And I thank Robert Cruz, professor of history, assistant professor at Stanford.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being with us. His book, again, For Profit, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, and Tsar. Thanks to you, Elena Danielson, archivist emerita at Hoover Institution, for being with us this hour as well.
My pleasure.
And we thank you, Princess Inez Storer, for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Also, thanks to Griff Williams, who joined us earlier from Gallery 16. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.